Hello and welcome to the menu on Monocle 24. I am Markus Hippi. This week we hear from a brand new Michelin star recipient, Mark Donald, whose restaurant operates at the oldest working distillery in Scotland.
It can't be a carbon copy of France because it won't work, and it can't be what's expected in a distillery. So yeah, I had to reconfigure how I was cooking slightly as well.
Then American author Lisa Steele tells us what we didn't know about eggs before.
If you hold an egg up to your ear, you shake it, and you can hear stuff sloshing around inside, the egg is old.
All that plus the week's top headlines and a dinner soundtrack recommendation ahead on this edition of The Menu here on Monocle 24. This year's Michelin Guide for Great Britain and Ireland has just been released. And, as usual, there are some surprises. Great news for Scotland is that the Glenturret Distillery in Crieff has been awarded its first star, which is spectacular considering that the Glenturret Lalique restaurant had been open for only 7 months. I spoke to the executive chef, Mark Donald, who first told me how he got the news of the prestigious award.
Yeah, it was done via video call. We didn't want to have a live ceremony just with COVID still lurking around. It was just a video call with Gwendal Poulenec, the head of Michelin. Yeah, he's just happy to award it to us. Yeah, it was a huge achievement for me and the team.
I know it happened quite quickly. You had been running the restaurant for 7 months. But did you have a feeling that a Michelin inspector may have visited your restaurant already?
We had an idea. I mean, you always think that it could be Michelin. That's why their madness of Michelin comes in, because you don't know who they are. Whereas so many other places announce after their meal. Michelin don't really do it. They're quite anonymous. So they keep you on your toes. We came in to the distillery with the level we wanted to cook at, and I think we're sort of matching that. And we're all from sort of good pedigree restaurants and backgrounds, not just myself, the floor team and the drinks team as well. We're all working towards a similar standard and goal. So yeah, it's always amazing to get recognised, but we were pushing for that.
Do you think this recognition will change something at the restaurant? Now, obviously, I would imagine it gives you a boost, motivation boost at least, but anything else?
I think the day-to-day probably won't change. I think it'll change exposure for the restaurant and the distillery. It won't change my job, so to speak, too much, because we're already working at a really high standard. But for the distillery, it's the first distillery in the world to get a Michelin star. So that's huge for Michelin, but it's also huge for the distillery and the wider whisky world. It's huge for Crieff. I think it's the first in Crieff. It's a sleepy little town. It's really pretty. So it'll bring a bit of tourism to Crieff. Yeah, and I think it changes things for Scotland a bit as well. Historically, it's just Edinburgh, now Glasgow as well. But it's nice for somewhere rural to get an award.
Absolutely, absolutely. You mentioned already that this is the first restaurant at a distillery to get a Michelin star. Let's talk about how this happened. You worked earlier at number one at the Balmoral in Edinburgh. What was it like to launch this restaurant? Now, what was waiting for you in Crieff when you promised to help to launch that restaurant and to relocate there?
I wasn't particularly looking to relocate, to be honest. We were out of the first lockdown and at number one, and I especially had a lot of time to sort of sit and assess how I was cooking and how I could be better. So when we came back after the first lockdown, we sort of hit the ground running and we were in our stride and cooking really nice food, and it was getting well received. But then we went to lockdown again, and I was approached by, I guess, a headhunter, a hospitality consultant, on behalf of John, who is the MD of Glenturret. And he said, there's this distillery looking for a chef. And I said, no chance. Because for me, a distillery, you know, the connotations of a whiskey distillery trying to do fine dining food or high-end food is shortbread and whiskey sauce and sort of tartan ribbons and all that sort of stuff. And then I came up and had a look at it because, you know, I was in lockdown anyway, so why not? And yeah, it just sort of obliterated my expectations of what it was going to be and what it actually was. Really beautiful resource behind it, being Lalique. Everything's really well crafted, very well thought out, and they had similar goals as to what I had for where they wanted to take our restaurant. So yeah, I gave my notice at number one after we retained the star, and the team soon followed.
And you said that you share the same goals with the French Lalique group that owns the Glenturret Distillery. What kind of goals were you talking about when you were about to launch?
Well, I wasn't going to leave my stable job in a well-renowned Michelin star restaurant for anything. You know, you'd be mad to leave a job during the pandemic anyway. never mind to open a restaurant or run a restaurant. This one was half built. But if you look at the league's track record with hospitality, they already have several vineyards across the world, mainly in France and California. That one's owned by Hans-Jörg Wyss. They have a one Michelin star restaurant. They have a two Michelin star restaurant. So it's not just some investors who want to open a restaurant but don't have any idea. They know what sort of investment is needed from the very start to make it successful. That was something that I wasn't really getting at the Balmoral, to be honest.
Tell me about what it was like to launch that restaurant then. I would imagine that when you go to a distillery and open a restaurant over there, not everything is ready over there. So how complicated was it?
It was difficult, especially with COVID and sort of supply chain issues and Brexit, and the weather up in this part of Perthshire is renowned for being challenging, let's say. But the support was always there from the distillery and from the owners. But yeah, I mean, even for me to come up here with a team, you know, there's that expectation again that you're going to be cooking whiskey cream sauce and overcooked chicken. So it's very difficult to come in and try and round that off. And the whiskey world, whenever I spoke to someone about it, a French company taking over a whiskey distillery, it doesn't really sit well. Like, what do the French know about making whiskey? And why is a crystal company coming to the Highlands of Scotland? And I had the same sort of worries, I guess. And for a cook, you don't want to cook inside that box either. It can't be a carbon copy of France because it won't work, and it can't be what's expected in a distillery. So yeah, I had to reconfigure how I was cooking slightly as well. It happened quite naturally after being at the distillery for a while and speaking to the guys who make the whiskey.
What was the conclusion like then? What do you do over there at the moment? What is your cooking like? How much inspiration do you draw from the whiskey world?
Well, for example, I got the guys who make the whiskey to take us on a tour, and they were explaining the whiskey making process. You know, there's extraction of sugars in the production of whiskey, and at certain temperatures, the barley does certain things. So we learned this and took it back to the kitchen. You know, we cook barley at 64.5 Celsius with only water, and that allows complex carbohydrates to gelatinize. And once those starches are gelatinized, they're broken down into alpha and beta amylase, into sugars, mainly maltose. So you've basically made a sugary water. Now that sugary water would then be turned into whiskey with yeast. But what we do is we use it in other applications, like in sauces or to glaze a piece of fish or to reduce it to make a reduction to want a dessert. And these are things that we would never have really known or fully understood had we not come to the distillery to learn about it or to work here.
Can you tell us about some of what you think are your star dishes at the moment? What do you think the customers have enjoyed most?
There's one that you sort of kick off with, and it's a tatty scone. You know, it's a classic Scottish breakfast dish, but we've sort of elevated that with Highland Wagyu and potato mayonnaise. But I'm from Glasgow, so I'm keeping to my roots slightly, but I'm sort of elevating dishes. We don't take ourselves too seriously with the food. But it's not, I don't think it's just the food that makes up the whole experience. There's brilliant service, there's really nice drinks. Yeah, and it's sort of tucked away in a little unassuming distillery. I think we're offering something quite unique.
Certainly, that's my impression as well. Tell me about the drink side as well, obviously, not only whiskey.
Well, we have a really talented drinks and service team. Julian is our executive sommelier. He's very young, but he's very experienced for his age already, having worked in Bordeaux, Alsace, Hong Kong. And our restaurant manager, Emilio, has worked previously with Heston at the Fat Duck, Marcus Waring, Simon Rogan. They're both really top of the game. Drinks-wise, what they're serving, cocktail-wise, we're picking a lot of wild botanicals from around the distillery and making shrubs and syrups that will go into cocktails, not just whiskey cocktails. Obviously, being at the distillery, we have access to quite a lot of things that the drinks world might not. So new make spirit, which is the whiskey before it goes into the barrels. So it's a clear spirit. It's about 64%. We're doing a new make martini with that. And Bob Dalgarno, the whiskey maker who was previously at Macallan, you know, he's got all sorts of things on the go. So behind the bar, there's a massive amount of rare drams and drops that no one else has access to that we can play with. And then there's obviously all the wine, which is on our wine list, which is over 300 different varieties, I think 4,000 bottles from all over the world. Huge selection of verticals from Bordeaux and Alsace, and also from Silvio Dense's private collection as well.
That all sounds great. I'm wondering, your Michelin star was announced this week. Have you already felt a boost in the number of reservations? How busy will it be at your restaurant in the weeks to come?
I think it will be really busy. I mean, the phone was off the hook yesterday from regular guests and people wanting to come and people being and want to come again. But I think it'll take a few weeks for it to fully sort of filter through media and everything. I mean, I was in London 2 weeks ago and no one had heard of the restaurant, which is disappointing, but it also shows that we still need to sort of get out there. And I think the announcement will do that. It'll bring this wee restaurant in Scotland to the forefront of people's attention.
I bet. Just finally, Mark, what kind of plans do you have for the future then?
I want to keep cooking at this level and evolving the restaurant. Last year was year zero. We opened at the end of July, the 28th of July, and we were open for 5 months. And then we had a small break in January, and we've been 17 days open in February. So we're very much in our infancy as a restaurant. This is only year one. So yeah, I want to take it further and see how far we can take it. I love living up here. The team love being here. Yeah, we're just a baby.
Mark Donald of the Glen Turret Lalique restaurant in Crieff there. His restaurant has just got a Michelin star. Let's next continue with this week's food and drink headlines. Here is Monaco's Paige Reynolds.
Thanks, Marcus. First up, new spirits are set to land in Southeast Asia as Japanese drinks maker Suntory Holdings is moving to expand in the region and in India. Suntory is the world's third largest spirits maker and in 2019 introduced a new whiskey brand sold exclusively in India. The company aims to more than double current sales in the country due to its growing popularity and the large whiskey market there. India accounts for half of global demand. In April, Suntory will also begin exporting its gin to Singapore, Vietnam, Thailand, the Philippines, Malaysia and South Korea. The gin uses ingredients like yuzu, green tea and ginger, giving Southeast Asia the chance to try distinctly Japanese flavours. Next to Finland, where researchers at the University of Turku have made some interesting discoveries as part of a pioneering study on cheese. They claim that their findings show that playing music to the cheese changes the product. The cheeses were taste tested and also subject to microbiological laboratory tests, having been played music at various frequencies and tempo. Both tests verified changes in the cheese, which differed depending on the frequency of the music. Elsewhere in Europe, the latest Michelin guide, Great Britain and Ireland, has been released. 25 restaurants were awarded new star ratings, including 9 new one-star restaurants and 5 new two-star restaurants. Longclume in Cumbria also became the first restaurant in the north of England to win 3 stars, the only new 3-star rating to be awarded. The guide is good news for the UK hospitality industry, with brighter times hopefully ahead after repeated lockdowns. Next up to Mexico, where lime inflation has reached unprecedented heights. The country is the world's largest producer of the citrus fruit, but price fixing by criminal groups has sent the prices soaring. This has prompted some eateries to stop offering limes alongside typical dishes like tacos. As a billion-dollar industry, the lime trade can be very profitable for cartels, who have started to impose increasing controls over producers to manipulate prices. While lucrative for criminal gangs, for the rest of the country, it leaves a sour taste. And finally, a decade-long study has found that coffee can help you live longer. The research involved almost 500,000 people and found that regular drinkers of the hot beverage were up to 12% less likely to die than non-drinkers. Up to 3 cups a day is the ideal amount, as exceeding this has no additional positive impact. But it's bad news for fans of instant powders. Benefits only arose from consuming ground coffee. That's all for this week. Back to you, Marcus.
Thanks, Paige. You are listening to The Menu on Monaco 24. You may think you know how to prepare eggs, but I bet a new book by the American author Lisa Steele will still surprise you. The Fresh Eggs Daily Cookbook has 100 recipes that use eggs in unexpected ways. So if you want to learn about crispy lemon-fried eggs, Swedish egg coffee or blueberry muffins, this book is for you. This is what Lisa told me a bit earlier.
I actually grew up in New England in the country. My grandparents had chickens and I grew up across the street from their chicken farm. They had 2-story chicken barn, you know, the real deal. They had an egg and chicken meat business, and they supplied other restaurants and diners and things like that. So I grew up in that kind of environment, and it was something that was very familiar to me. And sort of find myself back here doing sort of the same thing, but in a very different way. It just kind of feels like this is where I belong.
Amazing. And now you have released your new book, The Fresh Eggs Daily Cookbook, over 100 fabulous recipes to use eggs in unexpected ways. And I have to say that it's an amazing book in terms of making eggs sound more exciting than I've actually ever thought about that before. So obviously, you know, you always think about eggs as something you may have on your breakfast, but not much else. But you are actually changing many people's perceptions with this book. Could you tell me about what you wanted to create when you started working on this book? What was your goal?
I think kind of what you touched on is to get people to think about eggs, not just for breakfast. When I first was pitching the idea to my editors, I just wanted two chapters, one savory and one sweet. And they said, well, you can't just write a cookbook with two chapters. We have to break it up. But I hated the idea of pigeonholing omelets for breakfast when an omelet is perfectly good for dinner with a salad or, you know, something like that. So I think just getting people to incorporate eggs into their diet more in different ways.
Do you think your perspective may be a bit different because you don't only write about eggs, you also raise chickens?
Yes, we always have a fridge full of eggs that I'm trying to figure out how to use. So yes, very different. But I think, I don't know what it's like overseas, but I know in the United States, these last 2 years, chicken keeping has gotten super popular because I guess there's a level of comfort. If you know that you can go out into your backyard and collect eggs, and if you have a garden and you can grow vegetables, you know, things like that, you know that you can feed your family and healthy. You know, I think that that's a great sense of comfort to people. So it's gotten super popular, and there are a lot more people raising chickens than there were even 2 years ago.
Now, how did you decide which recipes to include in this book? And how did you discover these recipes? Have you been collecting them from different sources? Or have you been trying some recipes at home, trying to come up with new ideas and new dishes?
It was a combination. Some are things I remember cooking with my mom and my grandmother. Others are recipes that, you know, are just on repeat here at our house because we do have so many eggs. And then there were things that I just felt needed to be included, like angel food cake or lemon meringue pie, lemon curd, creme brulee, things that eggs really are the star. And then other things, yes, I tried toad in the hole, for example, you know, I had never made before, but just things that I thought would be interesting for people, something a little different. Nothing too complicated and nothing with 45 ingredients that you're only going to use once.
Well, many of these recipes are actually rather unexpected. Let's talk about that in just a moment. But before that, shall we cover a bit of basics? So we know that you should always try to find fresh eggs. But I guess my first question would be, how can you know how fresh your eggs are?
It can be really hard, you know, if you're not buying from a friend or a neighbor or you have your own chickens in the supermarket, eggs can be weeks and weeks and weeks old. But simple, easy trick, when you get home, put an egg into a glass of water, and if it sits on the bottom, it's nice and fresh. And then as it gets older, it starts to rise up a little bit because air is getting into the egg. I do this a lot because, you know, we have eggs that sometimes do sit for a while. If you hold an egg up to your ear and you shake it and you can hear stuff sloshing around inside, the egg is old because the insides have evaporated and the egg inside has room to move around.
What about the color of the shell? Does it matter?
No, the eggshell color is completely dependent on the breed of chicken. Certain chickens have different color pigments, either blue or brown, that they apply to the eggshell. All eggs start out white, and then depending on the breed, a pigment is applied to the outside of the shell.
Another question I'm asking on behalf of many people, I bet. How do you fix the issue of boiled eggs that are hard to peel?
That's the one problem with fresh eggs is they are notoriously hard to peel. And a lot of times people just recommend letting your eggs get old because then they peel well. But because the egg has lost that moisture, you're not going to get a perfect shaped egg. You're going to get that dip in one end, which if you're making deviled eggs, for example, is not very pretty. So if you steam your eggs in a double boiler or a colander or something over simmering water for 12 minutes for hard boiled and then put them right into ice water, they will peel perfectly. I've done that even with eggs that were laid that day.
Then a question about storing eggs. How should you do that?
So again, in Europe, I think it's different because I know eggs do not have to be washed. Here in the United States, eggs sold commercially have to be washed, so they have to be refrigerated. But if you're getting eggs that haven't been washed from a farmer's market, from your own chickens, from a neighbor, those eggs can stay out on the counter for a good couple of weeks and still be good. If you do wash them, you have to put them in the fridge, and they will last a lot longer in the fridge, like months.
Well, as I mentioned already, the name of your new book is The Fresh Eggs Daily Cookbook. Over 100 fabulous recipes to use eggs in unexpected ways. What do you think are some of the most unexpected ways you have discovered?
A lot of people are surprised that you can make your own mayonnaise, and they're surprised that there are eggs in mayonnaise, surprisingly enough. But things like hollandaise sauce or tartar sauce, I mean, there's just so many sauces and things that you can make out of eggs. And then fun things like marshmallows or homemade sprinkles for cupcakes, things like that, that I think people wouldn't necessarily go to right away when they think of an egg.
Shall we talk about a few recipes I discovered from your book? I'm curious about Swedish egg coffee.
Yeah, that one, I actually, years ago, I had written about that on my blog because I had come across it. And apparently in like a lot of the Lutheran churches, they call it Lutheran church coffee as well. But adding a whole egg, shell and all, into your coffee grinds and then, you know, percolating your coffee, it pulls a lot of the acidity out of the coffee to make a much smoother cup of coffee, and also makes the grounds sink to the bottom. So you're almost making like a homemade French press. It's really weird, but it actually works and it does make a nice cup of coffee.
Amazing. Another thing I discovered from this book, actually Monocle staff members know this thing rather well thanks to a Nordic cafe we used to have on the other side of the road. Finnish munavoi, or egg butter spread.
Yeah, that's something that my grandmother used to make. And I mean, you're basically just mashing hard-boiled eggs into butter. And I think that that came about maybe because butter was hard to come by. So you could sort of make it last longer if you added some eggs to it. And, you know, it's for toast or however else you'd use regular butter.
One more thing, egg lemon soup.
I really like that. I like the brightness that lemons bring to eggs, and soup with rice in it, it just makes it like a nice hearty bowl. That's just such a happy soup. I really love that.
What do you think? How much evolution is there, or are people still making new discoveries on various ways of using eggs in cooking?
Yeah, you know, eggs are, I feel like they're almost like two foods. Like a yolk does one thing to dishes. It adds flavor, it adds fat, it adds nutrients. And the white helps to just kind of bind everything together. And it, if you're going to beat your egg whites, you're going to add rise to souffles or things like that. So I think the science of eggs and how using eggs in recipes does different things is always going to fascinate people. I mean, I find eggs fascinating. I think it's hard to find a recipe sometimes that don't have eggs in them.
That's very true. Well, you have just released your new book. I wonder if you have any ideas for your next one yet.
I do. I have to say that my mom started sending me egg recipes as soon as I told her I was working on this book. She is still sending me egg recipes that she finds in magazines, or she writes them down if she sees them on TV. I have a folder probably 4 inches thick of more recipes that, I mean, I didn't even touch on crepes, or, I mean, there's just so many other things to do with eggs that I just didn't have room to talk about.
They're going to be included in the follow-up book. Just finally, Lisa, I wonder, how many eggs do you enjoy every week or day?
You know, in the summer when our chickens are all laying and our ducks, we can be collecting a dozen eggs a day. So, I mean, I generally start off with two for breakfast, as does my husband. And then, you know, depending on what we have for lunch, whether it's egg salad or something like that. So, I mean, we could be eating close to, you know, 8 or 10 or 12 eggs a day. I'm sure my doctor wouldn't love to hear that. It's not every day, but I mean, eggs are super nutritious, so I don't worry about it.
Lisa Steele there. She has just released the Fresh Eggs Cookbook. And that's all for this edition of The Menu. Remember that we are back with a new episode again on Friday at 20:00 London time. That's at midday if you're listening in Portland, Oregon. Meanwhile, do check out our menu spin-off show Food Neighbourhoods for great recipes. This show was edited and mixed by David Stevens, and I am Markus Hippi. Once again, we finish this programme with a dinner soundtrack recommendation. Here are Rokesop and Alison Goldfrapp with Impossible. Thanks for listening. Yeah.